Welcome to the Rounds to Residency podcast, brought to you by Med School Coach. Each episode, get clinical rotation advice and tips to prepare for your externships and residency in healthcare. We interview preceptors and physician educators who will prepare you for your rotation and improve your clinical experience. Now, here's your host, Chase DeMarco.
Dr. Stephen Beeson is a medical doctor and a two-time best-selling author whose books are aimed at improving clinicians' well-being and mental health while considering their continuing professional development and patient care. He's also the founder of the Clinician Experience Project, which is an innovative coaching-based app for clinical practitioners. Stephen, welcome to the show.
No, I'm delighted to be here.
So I do have a question to start off with and kind of curious to hear your thoughts on this, since you are doing a lot of things in medicine and sort of education. So how do you think that you are changing medicine or medical education for the better?
That's a great question. And I think all of us think about, as we get a little bit older, what's our dent in the world? And as a family medicine physician dedicated to making care better for patients, I think my purpose really, in addition to being a father and a husband, is helping clinicians become their best and doing so in a way that allows them to massively contribute to better care and to do so in a way that allows them to say no regrets about going into medicine.
I like it. And we're definitely going to come back to some of the works that you are working on right now, some of your projects towards the end. For the student audience, I'm kind of curious to know, what are some of the main points that you help physicians on? And especially since we're sort of going into the residency season, what are some things that the student audience might be able to gain from your insights?
It's a great question. I think that it's really important as a medical student, particularly third and fourth year and throughout residency programs, to figure out what kind of clinician do I want to be and to understand the kind of the scope and breadth of competencies. I mean, ACGME has a set of competencies and milestones that everybody has to be able to do, and accreditation is dependent upon delivering those elements of education. But as we figure out the kinds of clinicians that are successful in today's delivery system are profoundly important. And we're pretty well trained on the ability to diagnose and treat medical conditions. But the other elements and competencies, although they are on the process competencies for ACGME, we don't have a lot of formal training in, which is, you know, things just as an example, you know, how do we facilitate patient participation in care in a participatory care model? There was an interesting study that was done in 2016 in the family medicine literature where patients actively felt involved in care decisions about 5% of the time.
Wow.
So we suck at that, basically. But every physician in training would get it right at a multiple choice test, right? And they go, oh, yeah, patient involvement and goal setting and active participation and managing their own disease is better than us telling them what to do. But the actual skills in facilitating patient participation is a very specific skill set, and we don't always get that. So, I mean, patient connectivity, patient communication is key. How to be a local team leader. You don't realize it, but you are the local team leader of your clinical microsystem, and how to do that and how to bring the best out of the people that you work with. How to be a great colleague. So people say, yeah, I love working with Dr. Beeson, or I love working with Dr. Smith. I mean, she's fantastic. She's always there when I need her, and she has great consult. And those elements are so important for success and the culture of a group. Your ability to be clinically efficient, you're going to be seeing 24 patients a day, and your ability to not dive too deeply down a rabbit hole with each and every patient and know how to be effective and efficient in kind of workflow, how to deliver on the value equation and bending the cost curve, given that clinicians are 80% of all care costs by virtue of our professional services and what we order and how we do things and how to adhere to evidence to reduce the cost burden of care is going to be critical. So all of those things are super important, and it's pretty hard to get all that done throughout the course of a residency, but it's really important to have a vision for what makes a really great clinician who's earning a real paycheck and working for a large integrated healthcare delivery system.
Yeah, and that's definitely not something that I'm aware of anyway from all of my colleagues at different medical schools that's ever covered during the actual medical school part of it. So even in your third, fourth year,
right,
unless you have a particular preceptor that's really in tune with these topics and discussing them with you, you're not really going to get this. And I'm not entirely sure how much a lot of residencies even cover this because they're so busy. Residents are just running around doing so much work every day. Like, right. How do you actually learn how to do some of these? So I guess that would be a great way to take this conversation for the audience is let's give them a little bit of rundown of how to implement some of these different topics you discussed. And I think maybe the patient trust and patient care, the connectivity there would be a great place to start because that's paramount for healthcare in general. And it's something that, you know, every patient complains about. Oh, my doctor came in, didn't even talk to me, didn't ask anything except for a couple of diagnostically relevant questions and then left and I never saw him again or something like that.
Right.
So what are some ways that the audience could really benefit and do better at this section?
It's really important to realize that I remember when I was learning how to do a history and physical as a medical student, I was worrying about just not making myself look like an idiot, you know? And you're just trying to figure out how to ask the right questions. And you didn't really have a diagnostic framework in your mind. And getting the differential diagnosis was tough. And you knew that you had to present to your attending. And you wanted to be able to put together your history and your past medical history and be able to have it flow in a coherent way. And so you're worried about just the mechanics of it. So the idea of how do we connect, express empathy, and develop trust with the patient is hard. So in looking at what is the cycle of learning that allows us to become really good at it, you know, for medical students that are on, and certainly, you know, PGY1, 2s, and 3s, whoever may be listening, you know, it's important to get the mechanics right in taking your history and doing your physical examination. And that's just a matter of reps. But knowing how to connect with patients is as important as your clinical skill in rendering a clinical outcome. And let me give you an example. There's another study that was done looking at physicians' ability to establish trust with patients. And what they found is that patients who rated their clinicians in the top decile of trust, meaning I trust my doctor, participated in a treatment recommendation almost 70% of the time, meaning they did what the doctor asked. That were rated in the bottom decile of trust, they had participation rates around 13%, meaning there's pretty significant and profound implications clinically on our ability to establish trust. So the first step of change is what I'm about to do in learning how to connect with patients is important enough for me to pay attention to it and to exercise effort for it. So that's the first step, to realize your ability to connect with patients. So they say, I've got the greatest doctor ever, and I'm going to stay here for a long time because I have an amazing physician, is not going to be by virtue of your clinical skill. It's going to be by virtue of your ability to establish a relationship. We have to have both, because if you're really an amazing connector, but you're a clinical hack, then you're a charlatan,
yeah.
Right? You got to be able to do both, right? So first is this stuff is super important. And secondly, it's very simple things. And when I coach and train clinicians about what do I need to do to be able to connect with patients, there's four emotions that patients must feel as a result of their interaction with us. They must feel heard. They must feel cared about. They must feel confident in you. And they must feel included. Okay? So those are the emotions. Those are the levers that we have to press. So we have to think about, gosh, if patients have to feel heard, then what do we do to render that emotion? Well, first of all, we've got to listen to them without interruption. And if you look at the literature that's been repeated 5 or 6 times, our average interruption time is about 11 seconds. And so our ability to be able to say, okay, I'm going to let the patient finish their story. And I'm going to pay attention with all the cues that say that I'm 100% dialed in. And I'm going to use continuers. Tell me more. Oh my gosh, that must have been tough. What happened next? That's interesting. Did that ever happen before? And so our ability, you know what it's like when somebody listens to you versus somebody goes, my wife does this to me. She like looks at her phone while I'm talking to her and I just stop talking. Because like, you're giving me cues that you're not listening to me. So envision what it's like to have somebody really listen to you and do that and to paraphrase the history. There's a variety of techniques that we could spend the entire time on how do we cultivate a sense of listening and how do we cultivate a sense of caring. There's a set of behaviors that render that. To give you just one example, if you look at the literature in terms of how frequently physicians respond to patients' expression of fear, worry, concern, meaning the expression of empathy, which is to acknowledge a patient's current situation, physicians respond, there's been 3 different studies now, respond to about 10% of patient's articulation of a fear, worry, or concern, acknowledge it in any way.
Jeez.
But again, in those same studies, which are done with hematologists, oncologists, which are an amazing group of clinicians in terms of their empathy, the physicians gave themselves incredibly high marks in terms of their ability to express empathy. So we're not even self-aware of what we're not actually doing. The signal of caring of my back really, really hurts, it is say, oh my gosh, there is nothing worse. You're in the right place at the right time. We're going to get you back on your feet again because we know that this is really tough for you. It sounds stupidly obvious, but having shadowed 800 clinicians in my 18 years of coaching physicians, even with a coach sitting in the room, we still can't do it. And I think it's in part, not that clinicians are distracted or not good students. It's just that they've never had the mentor, the coaching, the opportunity to realize that this set of behaviors is profoundly important in terms of their capacity to become really great clinicians in the eyes of patients, because patients will assess a physician by virtue of their ability to make them feel heard, cared about, confident in them, and included. So, you know, and there's, anyway, we can go on and on, but those are just a little thumbnail of some of the simple things that clinicians can do.
I just, while you were discussing these topics, I noticed a lot of similarities in like material on how to have a happy marriage. It sounds like maybe this is a cultural phenomenon. We're just not good at empathizing and listening to each other and really figuring things out. So I just had to point out that kind of similarity there. But I guess if you get good at one of them, it's also going to help the other aspects of your life too. So it's a very important just life skill in general, not just for clinician experience.
No doubt.
And then, all right, so the next topic that you brought up was sort of the leadership and getting along with your colleagues. And this is becoming more and more important, it seems. There's a lot more interaction between different departments and even teams of physicians going to see their patients. So what are some ways to navigate this, and not just with your other physician colleagues, but with the rest of the staff in all different aspects of healthcare?
Absolutely. Again, this is also super important. You look at the inpatient data. About 25% of nursing will leave by virtue of their interaction with a clinician. And departure of a single nurse is 2.5 times their annual income. That's a cost. If physicians are unapproachable, that compromises a culture of safety and being able to identify pending harm because the physician is intimidating. And so there's a lot of implications in terms of culture, retention of talent, reduction of harm events, in terms of how it is that we interact with our nursing staff. And how it is we interact with our colleagues. There was a study that was done that showed that physician-to-physician collegiality, meaning I hang out with a group of clinicians that help each other, support each other, are there for one another, is a very compelling countermeasure to burnout. And so learning the set of skills of how do I become a good colleague? So in the Clinician Experience Project, we have a curriculum on being a good colleague. There's 3 criteria just to give you a sense of what that means is, number one, you send good referrals, meaning a clinician who dumps on their colleagues by sending crappy referrals is going to unravel the culture of that group. So you want to follow clinical guidelines, have the appropriate workup, and ask specific questions and do your work and, you know, provision that so the specialist is well positioned. Secondly, we position each other well, meaning if a patient arrives at the cardiologist's office after a referral from me, the physician receiving cardiologist would say, hey, I see Dr. Beeson is your primary care physician, really one of our best, and has done a really nice job, and I'm happy to join the team to help better care for you. So when I make the referral to the cardiologist, I'll say, you know, I'm going to have you see Dr. Gillespie. He's the doctor that trains other doctors. And if I needed to be able to have a cardiologist, that's who I want to see. And that's a tactic. That's a skill of positioning each other well. And the third element in our curriculum of being a good colleague is simply being there for each other. So if you're a neurologist on call for the weekend, you get a call for the primary care physician, for somebody with a cervical radiculopathy, with a progressive neurological defect, and you're going, man, I'm worried about this guy. And the neurologist, instead of doing the collective eye roll and sigh and, oh my God, you're sending him to an emergency room, it is send him on down, I'll take care of it. And that sense of what does it mean to be a good colleague and to develop the skills to allow you to be a good colleague. And I can assure you, if you're not a good colleague, you're not going to do well in a group environment. And so it's being a good colleague. It's being fantastic with nursing, where you honor them, respect them, tap their ideas, appreciate them, encourage them, coach them, ask them for feedback. How could I be a better help and support to you? Those are skills. And I can assure you, finishing residency and medical school, being awesome with nursing and awesome with colleagues and awesome with patients is, let's just say there's variance about that. There's some that are really good at all of it, but it requires a learning stance to say, I finished my residency, I finished medical school, I now have to learn how to really become a physician, how to be a great for my colleagues, how to be great as a team leader, how to be great with the patients, and learning never stops. So
I really like that part. I don't actually think I've heard someone recommend that before, but it makes so much sense, is to ask feedback from the other staff, from the nurses, from your other colleagues that are in a different profession than you. But when was the last time you actually saw a physician ask for feedback from someone else? I'm sure there probably aren't a lot of stories out there about it.
No, it is. It's part of what we call growth mindset. And growth mindset is a critical leadership skill. And growth mindset is hungry for knowledge, chronic student, and I can get through anything if I work hard enough. And
getting rid of that ego.
Yeah, it's honors and celebrates feedback as opposed to being threatened by feedback. So that's a big part of a culture of safety. If you're going to have all eyes out front for pending harm, you have to have people who are on the care delivery system that honor feedback and celebrate the good catch, as opposed to shut up, nurse, I'm the doctor. You know who I am? And I'm talking about killing people. That's what how it happened.
I have a lot of nurse friends and they've all given me a lot of stories like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, there are a lot of ACGME core competencies, and I'm sure most of them are not things that are really brought up in the medical school aspect, hopefully in some residencies. But there's another one that you said that really stuck out to me, because it's also one that we're just not that familiar with. It doesn't get brought up a lot. And that was the cost curve. If you think about stories you've heard from someone, all they see is the bill for the test, for the scans, but you don't necessarily get the physician breakdown. What is it costing for that level of service? So how does that affect patient care? How can we make a difference in that?
If you look at the sort of the Dartmouth data on regional costs of care delivery, first of all, there's no, if any, correlation between how much money we spend on patients and how well they do clinically. More care is not always better care. And sometimes it can be iatrogenic illness and unnecessary care that renders harm. So the, you know, learning how to be a steward of resources is as important as patient connectivity, as important as clinical excellence, as important as a good teammate, as important as good with nurses, as important as an ambassador for safety. And, you know, and not only is it reducing the cost burden of 17% of our GNP going to healthcare, it often is better clinical care. And there's a couple of things that groups now that, you know, medical students and residents should be aware of, where in an academic medical center or going through your medical training, you're not really thinking about what is this cost. But just to let you know, where you'll go into eventually is they'll track things like, what are your complex imaging utilization? What is your laboratory cost per member per month? What is your pharmacy cost per member per month? And you may get that back on a dashboard. And they're not going to incentivize you on it, but you're going to see where you stand in the curve. And you say, gosh, my utilization of complex imaging is 2.5x more so than anybody else in my specialty. Maybe I should consider looking at the clinical guidelines for the appropriate utilization of an MRI study for lower back pain before I start ordering an MRI on every single patient who asks for one. And so those are important things, because there's profound implications. Because if you are a part of a group that's paying you a good salary and you are doing things that's making the group expensive, then the payers will look at that group and say, no, we're going to tear you out of network. Because I can assure you that payers are looking for those that are delivering on the value equation, which is cost over quality. And so the ability, I should say quality over cost, but the ability to render and to be a steward of resources is super important. And whether that be, you know, the basics are adhere to evidence and care guidelines to help and support the appropriate utilization and treatment for most of the chronic diseases that we see. number two, active patient participation, meaning, you know, patients who are participating in care will typically opt for things that are less expensive and more conservative. So when we take their ideas and their goals in mind, not everybody with class four heart failure who's 87 years old is one going to go in the hospital repeatedly for CHF exacerbations. They may say, time out, I want to spend time with my grandkids and I want to be able to be at home. And you bring up hospice care, which is, I've never made a hospice referral where the family hasn't said, holy smokes, I wish we would have done this earlier. And so clinicians that are mindful of the levers of cost, which is honoring patients' wishes and trying to do what's right and best for them, adhering to evidence and clinical care guidelines, generic medication utilization when appropriate, appropriate utilization of complex imaging according to guidelines, and choosing wisely is a great campaign that allows people a backstop to say, gosh, I know that your neighbor who's a chiropractor said you should be getting an MRI scan, but this is a great question, and I'm so glad you asked it. And there's a body of experts that have helped us with this on this thing called choosing wisely as to when the appropriate time to get an MRI scan is. And you've got a backstop. So it's not just you, but it's you and a whole body of experts, and having things like choosing wisely behind you to help that. And knowing the skill of having a conversation when patients are requesting medically unnecessary tests, because you have to be able to navigate that. Because if you go in there with, you don't need an MRI scan, and the patient says, we want an MRI scan, those are positions. You can't negotiate from positions. You can only negotiate from a shared interest. And you need to know how to articulate, empathize, hear, value, and create a shared interest to be able to negotiate away from just going to war with a patient regarding getting the MRI or not getting the MRI. And again, that's another skill that clinicians learn. Yeah, it's tough.
That has to be so difficult for pediatricians in particular, between vaccines and giving antibiotics for viral illnesses. Like, they probably get that dozens of times a day. So it's definitely a good skill, especially if you're in kind of the primary care aspect.
It's fascinating. There was a study that was done out of the UK that showed that over 50% of physicians give inappropriate care out of fear the patient's going to be receiving a patient satisfaction survey.
Wow.
We've emphasized this consumerism and make the patient happy at all cost, but that has an unintended consequence of prompting clinicians to do things that perhaps are not medically appropriate. So anyway, that's just one more reason that we need to be able to learn how to have these conversations.
And the Choosing Wisely campaign is definitely a good resource for the audience. They have a lot of great material on there. Between that and the Curbsiders podcast, I love a couple of episodes they do called Things We Do for No Reason. So, a lot of stuff that's just been passed down from generations, but there's no actual like evidence-based reason to do it. So definitely some good resources to check out. Well, I think we've covered some really good topics. And of course, we could go on for hours if we were to cover every core competency. But I think we'll leave the audience with this. And I'd like to know if you have any parting thoughts or ideas for them.
So first of all, if there's medical students and residents on, you've chosen a great life. Medicine, the job as a healer, is an extraordinary one. And all those people that say medicine sucks, don't listen to them. Because the ability to make a difference in the lives of patients is an extraordinary human experience. The ability to collaborate with really smart colleagues and to bind together on a common purpose is a really amazing journey. And you have a chance to be able to make a meaningful impact with the people you work with and the patients that you treat. And nobody can take that away from you if you choose to step forward and assume a role and persona that allows you to manifest. And to realize becoming a great clinician is a long journey. And I encourage you to not only master the technical elements of the differential diagnosis and physical examination and all those things you've been working so hard on, but also there's lots of other things that make for great clinicians and how we interact with our patients and how we interact with our colleagues and our staff and how we leverage our influence to make the people around us better. And I encourage you to become lifelong learners to be able to accommodate those things.
Definitely agree. I think those are great parting words. And then obviously with your books and the Clinician Experience Project, and we'll put the links to these in the show notes, but where can the audience find out more about you and what you're working on?
as I've dedicated myself to coaching and training and developing clinicians, I've got a team of amazing people. We've developed this app-based coaching platform called the Clinician Experience Project. It's designed for organizations. You can find it at practicingexcellence.com. And my books, Practicing Excellence, A Physician's Manual to Exceptional Healthcare, and Engaging Physicians, A Manual to Physician Partnership, are certainly available on Amazon. And my email is Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, at practicingexcellence.com. And love hearing from people that are emerging as newbies into this amazing profession. So feel free to reach out anytime.
That's great. And I hope this has been very beneficial for the audience and that some people reach out, because I know we can all do better on all the topics we've discussed today. But I want to thank you again, Dr. Stephen Beeson, for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
Are you looking for productivity and study coaching? You can now register for a free 30-minute session with me, sponsored by Prospective Doctor. To register, go to prospectivedoctor.com/chase and register for a 30-minute coaching session. And if you decide to use their MCAT or USMLE tutoring services, you can now use the code CHASE10 and receive 10% off of your purchase of up to $400. Just enter CHASE10 to get your discount now.
The Rounds to Residency podcast is powered by Med School Coach. To access Med School Coach services, like USMLE tutoring or residency admissions advising, visit our website at medschoolcoach.com. Good luck as you prepare for your board exams, and we hope you tune in again next time.